Let me invite you this morning to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. We have been away from this new series for a couple of weeks. And today we're starting the second chapter. Actually, our text is fairly long. It's verses 1 to 11 because all of that hangs together as a unit. Ecclesiastes 2, starting at chapter 1. If you were here a couple of weeks ago, you know that we were looking then at the last section of chapter 1. Our text at that time was chapter 1, verses 12 to 18. And the theme of the message, the theme of that passage was the limitations of wisdom. The limitations of wisdom. The very next day, that Monday, I was pulling up to a parking lot, and as I pulled in, I looked up at the car that was backed in front of me, and I saw the license plate, where here in South Carolina, you can get a license plate, don't have to pay extra, that says, "In God We Trust." And I looked up, and this particular South Carolina plate said, "In reason we trust." That was the phrase that they had put on their license plate. And it reinforced for me the ongoing need for a book like Ecclesiastes. Here is the wisest man on earth who is all about wisdom, who is all about knowledge, who would view our reason as a great gift, a great tool from God. But at the outset, even as he is beginning to use his wisdom, to use his knowledge to analyze life, he emphasizes the point that wisdom is not going to save you. And wisdom is not going to solve all of your life's problems. It is not going to answer all of the questions you have. And it is not going to bring you ultimate satisfaction. And so we had that emphasis on the limitations of wisdom. Well, if the world's creed, and this is the case for many, many secular people, if the world's creed is "In reason we trust," what do you think they might say would be their motto? Like what summarizes the pursuits, what they're actually doing, what they're after in life? I think we could maybe summarize their motto not so much "In reason we trust," but perhaps we could say "For pleasure we live." That also is a good summary of what is going on in the hearts and in the lives of so many, many people. For pleasure we live. Well, that is exactly the issue that Solomon takes up here in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. As he continues assessing life under the sun, he is going to take up now the theme of pleasure. And he is very straightforward in this section. It's not hard to understand. That's one reason we can take a larger chunk like this, because it's fairly simple. And it is fairly deductive. In fact, the way this is outlined, it's almost like he's writing a paper for English class, or like he's preparing a sermon outline. He starts with his introduction. In verse 1, the first half of the verse. Then in chapter 2, verse 1b, and through chapter 2, verse 2, he gives us his thesis or his proposition. And then verses 3 to 8, he develops that. We find the development or kind of the proof of his thesis. And in verses 9 to 11, his conclusion. Introduction, thesis, development, conclusion. That was his outline, and so it's going to be my outline this morning as we go through step by step what he is saying here under the guidance of the Spirit, talking about pleasure. Well, he does give us a little introduction in verse 1a. "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself." Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? When was the last time you read a verse of the Bible talking that way or describing somebody's pursuit? I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. It's important to define some of the words that he uses as he introduces his topic. First of all, the verb test. Actually, that is a fairly common word in the Old Testament. The first time that it shows up is in Genesis 22:1, where it says God tested Abraham. And there are many times when the Lord puts people to the test. And actually, there are many times where inappropriately they test God as well, using the same word. And this was a theme, this was an issue that Solomon would have been familiar with, because we read in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 1, that when the Queen of Sheba shows up from far away to see what she had only heard regarding the glories of his kingdom, it says that she tested him with many hard questions. He had been put to the test. He had been challenged. He had been tried to see the level of his wisdom, to see what he was made out of. And now that very same word is what he is doing with reference to the pleasures of life. He is carefully examining them in order to determine the nature and the value of pleasure. Actually, what he says is, speaking to himself, right? I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. And it's not only that he is testing pleasure, what he is actually doing is he is testing his own heart with reference to these pleasures of life. What he is doing is he is assessing the degree to which pleasure corresponds to his nature, to his inner man. And all throughout this passage, we want to keep in mind that this is a test. Even though what Solomon did was over the top, and even though some of it was terribly immoral, Solomon was not your typical profligate. There was a kind of recklessness about his life as he describes it here. But at the same time, there was a real intentionality about his choices. While he is pursuing pleasure, what he is actually doing is conducting a philosophical or a religious experiment whereby he is testing the relationship between these pleasures and his own heart. What is pleasure anyway? That's the other term that we need to define here. That's what he is looking at. The Hebrew word for pleasure could be translated in a number of ways. You could translate it joy or gladness or mirth. It's used in a lot of different circumstances in the Old Testament. It's used, for example, to describe the euphoria that the Israelites felt as they were celebrating a great victory in battle. If you think about a scenario like that, the feelings of the heart in a moment like that, the being pumped up, the excitement, the delight, maybe not that intense, but at other occasions it's used as well, just for a feast that they might celebrate, even a religious feast of worship that God had laid out, whereby they are remembering some great event in the past, some great work of God in the past, and there is this excitement, this euphoria, this pleasure, this joy that they're experiencing. And when Solomon takes up that concept, and as you read the rest of the passage, you realize it that he is applying it to any number of experiences of daily life, any number of human experiences that produce a good feeling, that give you sensory delight. And in fact, when he goes on to say, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself, that is a very broad expression. Literally, it just means see or experience good. He is opening the door wide to pursue any avenue for pleasure and anything that might make him feel good. That literally is what he is doing. Testing the philosophy of life that says, if it feels good, do it. We call that hedonism, which is an English word that comes from the Greek word for pleasure. That's what Solomon is investigating. That is what he is kind of putting under the microscope to test and to see how it matches up with what is going on in his heart. And what was the result of that investigation? We're moving now in the next part to his actual thesis. As he comes into the second half of verse 1, he says, "But behold, this also was vanity." That's his thesis. Pleasure is vanity. That was his thesis, and so that's our theme this morning, the vanity of pleasure. But here again, we have to define our terms, and we're encountering a term that I've already emphasized in this series and that is going to come up a lot. That's that word, vanity. It's a word that means breath or vapor. And as I've pointed out a couple of times already, it's a live metaphor. And so we have to ask, what is the point that he is trying to make about life being like a vapor in this or that passage? It's actually going to change depending on the context, because life in more than one way is like vapor. And you remember the main options that I shared with you. When Solomon makes these kinds of statements, he could be saying that life is fleeting, that it doesn't last very long, that life is unsubstantial, that it doesn't have concrete substance that he can enjoy and that matches up to his nature as a being made in the image of God. Or very often it refers to life being sort of slippery or enigmatic. It's elusive. You can't understand it. So which one is it in this passage or in any passage? Or is it some kind of combination of those ideas? I think in this case, the next verse is really going to help us, because in verse 2, he elaborates a little bit on his thesis, and he says, after this also was vanity, "I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it?" He says of laughter, which is talking about the actual, you know, sound that comes out of your mouth and the feelings of happiness when you enjoy something, when something strikes you as funny, comedy, humor, whatever. He says about that, it is mad. Now, there are other places where Solomon talks about laughter, and it's very clear that he does not believe that laughter is wrong or that it is out of place. So, for example, in Proverbs 17:22, this is the Net Bible translation, it says, "A cheerful heart brings good healing." A cheerful heart brings good healing. It has this positive healing effect to be an upbeat, happy person, or to have that sort of response to life. There are benefits to laughter. And most of us would rather be around people that are cheerful than people that are gloomy. There's a positive effect. We all enjoy that. There's nothing wrong with it. However, Solomon also said this in Proverbs 14:13, "Even in laughter, the heart may ache, and the end of joy may be grief." And he says in this book, Ecclesiastes 7:3, "Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better." This business of laughter is kind of complicated. There's not one simple explanation for how to think about humor and laughter. We've got to take them all into consideration when we analyze this topic, and especially not go too far as to suggest that Solomon is saying here that it is totally inappropriate. What he is saying when he says laughter is mad, he's talking about it in the context of what he is discussing at this point in Ecclesiastes. What is he talking about? Remember, he's looking for profit, chapter 1, verse 3. He's looking for that which human beings can enjoy in a deep, in a permanent, in a soul-satisfying way, that after they've made all of their investments into this or that endeavor, they can keep, and it's going to match up to the substance of who they are. And he says, as far as that's concerned, even though laughter has some benefits and it's not a bad thing, as far as that's concerned, if you're looking for that which will bring wellness to your heart, as far as that purpose is concerned, laughter is actually foolish. you are being a fool to think that this sort of superficial happiness is going to satisfy you at a deep level, that it's going to give you the heart joy that you're craving. In fact, isn't it true that often what we use laughter for is to distract us from the things that really are concerning our hearts, what's really burdening us, what really we desire? We use laughter as a kind of way to sort of shove that out of our minds temporarily. Obviously, laughter is not going to satisfy you. And then he says, of pleasure, these are kind of overlapping words, and of pleasure, what use is it? Here again, Solomon is talking about pleasure accomplishing the deepest longings of the human heart. Not that it doesn't do anything, not that it has zero value, but in terms of the quest he is on for that which matches his nature, it is of no use for that purpose. The answer is, what use is it? Nothing. So, with that in mind, looking at verse 2, when I look at verse 1 and it talks about life or about pleasure being a vapor, I'm thinking primarily in terms of pleasure being unsubstantial, or we might say empty. All of these experiences may feel good. They are not necessarily wrong in every case. They may have, they do have a place in the plan of God for your life, but they lack ultimate substance. They are not weighty enough to match up to the human heart. And now Solomon is going to develop that proposition that pleasure is empty in that sense. And so we come to verses 3 to 8 and his development of that thesis. And what he does to develop the thought is to give us a catalog of various means of pleasure that he personally and that he thoroughly investigated. It is an impressive list when you put all these things together. And I would say it's also a timeless list. In other words, even though there are some details here that are very particular to Solomon and to his unique position in the ancient world, really these things end up forming categories that for all of human history have attracted and to this day continue to attract the attention of people because of their capacity for pleasure. So what are these things? I don't know why he started with this one, but actually the very first thing on his list is alcohol. Look with me at verse 3. I search with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. What we read here is that Solomon, among other things that he is carefully testing, he is investigating the physical effects of alcoholic beverage, and yet he is doing so, as he says here, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. Evidently, he is partaking of that to a certain point to where he has not totally lost his senses. He is taking enough of it to know something of its pleasure, but not coming to the point where it significantly impairs his mental processes. Remember, this is all a test, and so his mind has still got to be in gear. This is not just total drunkenness and debauchery as far as wine is concerned. What is interesting, as he gives a parallel thought in this verse, he had talked about cheering my body with wine, and then he says, and how to lay hold on folly. In other words, he is closely associating the effects of alcohol with folly. When he thinks about wine and even whatever positive effects and good feelings, it's like there's just a very short step between talking about the effects of wine and folly. It's all kind of in one package here. And yet, he is still looking for something good there. What good there might be in such drinks. And actually, as far as that question of what good you might find in wine for the children of man under the sun. He is not going to specifically answer that in this particular passage. There are some other statements, two other statements about alcohol in the book of Ecclesiastes. The main one is in chapter 9, and we're not going to be there for some time, but when we get there, I will probably do a whole kind of side message on the topic of alcoholic beverages. I think it is a good and necessary topic to bring up scripturally from time to time. One of the things that we'll get into more as we get to that passage is that there is a considerable difference between the alcoholic content of ancient wine and alcoholic beverages as we know them today, and that difference has got to have a big impact on how we apply the biblical statements that we find, particularly in the Old Testament. I'm sort of delaying that topic because it's really not developed at this point, but clearly what's happening here is that Solomon is considering this as an option, and he's exploring this. He is testing this method of pleasure. And as we think about that, I don't want us to get distracted about questions of are we supposed to drink alcohol today or not. That's really not the topic under discussion in this passage. Let's keep our focus on his question here. His question is, to what degree does alcohol satisfy the human heart? And isn't it the truth that so many people who drink alcohol, they are looking for heart satisfaction? They are using it as a mechanism to cope with the burdens of life, looking for an escape, looking for joy, looking for something to satisfy them. What does Solomon say is the end of that? How does he answer that question? Well, we've already seen it suggested at the beginning, and we're going to come back to it at the end of the passage. But we got to move on to the next means of pleasure here. He moves on from alcohol to these building projects that he became famous for in verses 4 to 6. I made great works. I built houses and I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. And the language there, if it rings a bell, it is reminiscent. Some of the terminology is exactly the same as what is used of God when he planted the Garden of Eden. In fact, the word that's translated here in our Bibles, parks, is the word from which we get the English word paradise. He's trying to create a kind of paradise on earth with these massive structures and these beautiful gardens, and even creatively using and adapting the powers of nature to irrigate these areas that he has cultivated. And in the ancient world, even as things are discovered today, we find ourselves impressed with the ingenuity of people. You think of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, you think of the Roman aqueducts and how they were able to harness the forces of nature in order to create these works of beauty. We're not going to take the time to do this, but if you read in 1 Kings chapter 7, you can get a lot of detail about how Solomon developed these works. In fact, he spent about twice the amount of time building his own palace as he did on building the temple. It was like 6 years for the temple and 13 years on his own palace. And he surrounded his court with all of these other works of art and these physical experiences for them to enjoy, cultivating actually creations of God. There is nothing inherently wrong with that. He is not encouraging or discouraging any of that today. He is saying, I pursued that. My purpose was, I'm going to test the degree to which this can satisfy my heart. Well, how would it be possible for somebody to build these amazing things? You can't do it all by yourself. You need some people to do the work for you or with you. And so in the next verse at the beginning, he gives us another aspect of pleasure when he says, chapter 2, verse 7, I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. As I say, practically speaking, he would have to have thousands of workers in order to accomplish what he did. But I think there are other things going on here when he speaks of these people carrying out his work, these slaves. There is a kind of pleasure that, particularly because of twisted human nature, a kind of pleasure that people experience in exercising authority over other people. That is probably part of what he is talking about here, that he was in this position of, in this case, just unquestioned, unlimited power, and had all these people at his beck and call, many of them actual slaves. There's a kind of pleasure that people derive from being in positions of power that way. And then there's also pleasure of just being able, through that, to live a life of leisure. Not that Solomon was just laying around doing nothing, but in terms of the dirty work, in terms of the menial labor, that was all being covered by all these people, to where he did have the freedom to spend a great deal of his time just studying nature and interacting with dignitaries, and in, as part of that, having these great feasts, and just generally being able to enjoy a relaxed life because of owning these slaves. And that leads us to the next avenue of pleasure, which is the enormous wealth that he accumulated that's described starting at the second half of verse 7. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. And one of the things that stands out to me in that statement and some of these other verses, you notice the times that he talks about I and me, and I did this for myself. And again, there's a very fine line that goes from legitimate pleasure and enjoying something that God has blessed you with to a life of just selfishness. And it seems to be that he explored pleasure to the point of selfishness as he keeps talking about, I did this for myself. I did this for myself. There's not really a whole lot here about the benefits of all of this for the people in his kingdom, though I'm sure that there were benefits. But he's talking about, I got this for myself. I enjoyed this myself. And when he describes his wealth, again, it's very helpful that there are other passages that fill it out. Let's go quickly to 1 Kings chapter 4. I mentioned chapter 7, which talks about his building projects. And we're going to look at a couple other statements, a couple other passages in 1 Kings that are describing his wealth. Go to 1 Kings chapter 4 and go to verse 22. It says, Solomon's provision for one day, that's the provision for his court, was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. We're not too familiar with those measurements, but it's estimated that one core is equivalent to 6 bushels. You can do the math and recognize the enormous amount. We're just talking here about flour and meal. We're going to have hamburgers and hot dogs for lunch. And listen to what it says about Solomon's daily provision. 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsa to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates, and he had peace on all sides around him. So here he is. There is evidently hunting that's going on. There is cattle farming that's going on. There is bringing of these exotic animals from other parts of the world. And we're talking in those numbers about the daily amount of food that was consumed just by his court. That's something of what he is referring to in Ecclesiastes. Then jump ahead to chapter 10 in 1 Kings. 1 Kings chapter 10. And look for a minute at verse 14. 1 Kings 10:14. Now the weight of the gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, besides that which came from the explorers and from the business of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and from the governors of the land. And here again we have estimates of what this would have amounted to. It's estimated that a talent weighed about 75 pounds. Multiplied by 666, you're talking about 50,000 pounds of gold that came in annually. And that's just the gold. It doesn't speak of the silver. It says in another place that silver was so common under his kingdom that it was as though it were nothing. And he gets all these exotic treasures and animals. And when he says in Ecclesiastes, the treasure of kings and provinces, that seems to be referring to the fact that he has these international contacts, and you've got these authorities over there in all parts of the world that are flooding him with these riches from all over the globe. Wealth was one of the chief means of pleasure that he pursued. And it doesn't stop there. Look at the second part of Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 8. He says, I got singers, both men and women. And we're speaking there of the pleasure of entertainment, particularly through music. Solomon had some interest and some knowledge in that area as well. Live music whenever he wanted it. Apparently professional singers whose main job was just to entertain him and his guests. And then he just kind of throws in this little comment at the end of verse 8 as another means of pleasure when he says in verse 8, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man, the pleasure of sexual relationships. And actually that phrase is difficult to translate. But in the Hebrew, it seems to be a very graphic and even demeaning way of picturing women as the playthings of the king. In fact, 1 Kings 11:3 tells us that he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. You know, whatever we may say about some of these other pleasures being appropriate, in this case, he is clearly abusing a gift of God. But given the power and given the wealth that he has at his disposal, even that he pursued, yes, hard to imagine how he could justify this in his mind, but even this, he is conducting himself a test. There's the list. Alcohol, enormous building projects, slaves, unimaginable wealth, entertainment at will, and unbridled sexual pleasure. What is it that Solomon concluded about all of that? He already told us at the outset his thesis that it's all vapor. And now in the conclusion, he is going to revisit that and drive it home. So we come to the conclusion in verses 9 to 11, and he gives us a little summary of what he has said. Verse 9, so I became great, and I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. You know, in some ways, you and I can and every day do enjoy greater pleasures than Solomon. You think about it this way, Solomon never drove in a car. He didn't have air conditioning. He never got on a plane and hopped over to France. Solomon didn't have the internet, okay? And there are many, many more avenues for pleasure, modern versions that we can enjoy. However, I don't think any of us will ever attain the scope and the variety of pleasures that Solomon was able to enjoy because of his position. And I bring that up to give us some perspective, particularly to young people who are used to preachers saying the kinds of things that I'm saying. Okay. And the temptation is to say, well, I want to try it out and, you know, see what it's really like, to see if this is really true after all. Okay? And I would say to you that you are wise to pay attention to the wisest man around who had available to him way more than you can possibly have, and not think foolishly that you need to conduct this same experiment as though you are going to end up with different results. Solomon said, whatever my eyes desire, I did not keep from them. In principle, in terms of categories, in terms of breadth here, none of us could reach this level. Just like in chapter 1, I was saying, look, if Solomon, the wisest man on earth, is saying wisdom isn't going to cut it totally, Solomon, the most experienced pleasure person on earth, is saying pleasure doesn't do it either. I mean, what else do you and I expect to conclude? Well, as he goes on in his conclusion, he is going to give us a positive assessment briefly in verse 10. When he says, I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. He didn't deny these things felt good. And he isn't dismissing the good feeling as necessarily a bad thing. In fact, he says, this was my reward for all my toil. And focus on the word reward there. More literally, it means portion, and it's another key word in Ecclesiastes. As we're going to see when it comes up later, this word portion, it speaks of a divinely allotted set of opportunities and circumstances and experiences that God cuts out for the life of the individual. He sort of breaks out of all the world some piece of it with parameters to rein it in, but it's not like he's throwing you out there not to enjoy anything. He has given you a certain portion of pleasure for you. And Solomon is just starting to tease out that idea here. We're going to come back to it. But what he leaves us with is the negative side as far as his test is concerned in verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Try to emphasize there the universals of that passage. He's talking about all and nothing. What he is saying here applies to everything that he has experienced. There is not an aspect of pleasure that somehow is an exception to the findings of Solomon. He's very broad in his language here. And about all of it, he says once again that it is vapor and that it is a striving after wind. I think that phrase, which we're encountering again, reinforces that unsubstantial idea. What is air? Air is gas. It doesn't have physical matter. It doesn't have substance that you can catch. It just is going to slip out of your fingers. There's nothing concrete to it, and that's what he's saying about all of these pleasures. And as if he hadn't said enough, he said there was nothing to be gained under the sun. That statement harkens back to chapter 1, verse 3, because it's the same language of profit. He wanted to know what man is profited by all the toil, and as far as pleasure is concerned, he says there is no profit. Again, it's not that they have no place. It's not that they don't bring you anything legitimate. There is a kind of satisfaction that is enjoyed. But as far as what he's talking about here, something of substance, something that truly matters in the sense that it corresponds to my deep nature as a human being, In the end, all of those things leave me empty. They leave me wanting more. They do not match up to who I am at the core. The fact is, human beings have a massive drive and a massive capacity for pleasure, and nothing earthly comes close to satisfying it. Our wanters are too big and too powerful for us to be satisfied by any of these sensual type pleasures. Now, if Solomon is kind of preaching a sermon here, you would expect him, having come to his conclusion, to say, all right, application. But actually, he doesn't give you an application, because the discussion keeps going and it doesn't end till the end of chapter 2. Actually, this whole passage, the extent of it, starts back in chapter 1, verse 12, and goes to chapter 2, verse 26. And so it's going to be a while until we get to the main application that he has in this chapter. But what you do find when you get to the end is actually kind of surprising. Look at what he says, starting at verse 24. Here's the application. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. What? What are you talking about? You have spent all of these verses saying how pleasure doesn't satisfy, and now you're saying there's nothing better for you than to enjoy whatever pleasure you have from God. Pleasure can't satisfy, therefore experience pleasure. That is actually the logic of this chapter. However, we need to qualify and clarify what he means when he talks about pleasure at the end. He is not talking about hedonism in the sense of living for pleasure. He is not talking about pursuing pleasure outside the parameters that God has laid down for you. He is not talking, certainly, about idolizing pleasure and seeking it as your God. He is talking about enjoying in their place the simple pleasures that God does bless you with, and doing so as an act of gratitude and worship toward God as the giver. Not just feeding your face with everything you could possibly want, but making your way through life, and whatever in the providence of God you have to enjoy, enjoy it, but don't stop there. Recognize that this is a reflection of a greater satisfier. Thank him for what he has blessed you with, and use it as an opportunity to seek him, to seek the Creator above the creation. Okay? That's what he means when he is inviting us to enjoy life. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to have to talk about it a lot, because that statement comes up about six times at several key points as one of the main conclusions of this book. What I want to do as we wrap up, since we're going to get to that application, is to close with some other thoughts of application that we can infer as we look at the book as a whole, and as we connect this theme of pleasure with the rest of the Bible. What else could be said about pleasure? What is it that he has been warning us against? I remember a couple years ago reading the story of a young lady named Kaylee Rogers from the city of Cumbria in England, who at the age of 16 in 2003 won the lottery. Anybody here 16 years old? Can you imagine? In her case, it was 1.9 million pounds, which would be about $3 million. 16 years old, and she won it. She hit it. And she quickly frittered it away, buying houses for her family members, luxury cars, throwing elaborate parties, undergoing cosmetic surgery to make herself look more attractive. And by 2009, at the age of 22, she had attempted suicide several times in response to a number of just overwhelming pressures that resulted from this money and the people she was connected with and even the law. And she was quoted as saying, "My life is a shambles, and hopefully now it is all gone, all the money, I can find some happiness. It's brought me nothing but unhappiness. It has ruined my life. I've just wanted to make people happy by spending money on them, but it hasn't made me happy. It just made me anxious that people are only after me for my money." It's a pretty good illustration of the point that Solomon has been making here by way of warning before he talks about the right use of pleasure, of what money will not be able to do for you. C.S. Lewis famously said this: "The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. There was something we grasped at in that first moment of longing which just fades away in the reality." Haven't you found this about any kind of earthly experience, that the anticipation is typically greater than the reality? "The wife may be a good wife, and the hotels and scenery may have been excellent, and chemistry may be a very interesting job, but something has evaded us. The Christian said, 'Creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists.' A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. I must take care, on the one hand, Ecclesiastes, never to despise or be unthankful for these earthly blessings, and on the other, never to mistake them for the something else of which they are only a kind of copy or echo or mirage. I must make it the main object of my life to press on to that other country and to help others do the same." That was C.S. Lewis. Jesus said it very concisely when he was talking to the woman at the well. And he said, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." And here we are today, getting ready to celebrate the Lord's table. How does all of this connect with that? It connects directly and in every way. Think about it this way: Jesus denied himself pleasure so that we could enjoy the pleasure that Solomon was craving. The heart pleasure that comes from knowing that you have been put right with your Creator, that your sins have been forgiven, that your conscience is clean, that you have access to God as your Father, that you are following the Father's will and portion for you, and that a home for you in that other world has been secured for you. Christ really is the answer to the longings that Solomon is describing here. And even as we taste these elements physically today, as we take them into our bodies, I pray that that experience itself, the physical experience, would reinforce for us the truth of the satisfaction of heart that only the Lord himself can bring us.